Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy New Year. Welcome to this end of the year podcast for the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. This podcast will explore the impact the Discovery Institute has had and continues to have on academic freedom, as well as scientific research that explores intelligent design. We'll also look at the impact the Discovery Institute is having on the broader culture and the vital services the Discovery Institute provides for scientists, students, and others who come under attack for challenging Darwinian orthodoxy. We start with Dr. Guillermo Gonzalez, a Center for Science and Culture senior fellow who experienced firsthand what so often happens to scientists who dare to step outside the confines of Darwinism. Dr. Gonzalez, tell us, first of all, your first experience with the discrimination that researchers receive when they're proponents of intelligent design or they want to do research in that area.
The first discrimination I personally encountered was at Iowa State University around 2005, when a number of professors wrote a petition that was circulated on campus and garnered over 120 signatures opposing intelligent design. And that set the stage, eventually, for the denial of my tenure, which those proceedings ended in February of 2008. So I had to leave Iowa State by that end of that semester.
What were they trying to say was so wrong about your desire to explore the idea that there was evidence of design in nature?
Well, the petition was led by, at first, by a small number of very vocal atheists on campus at Iowa State who saw intelligent design as a kind of under-the-radar attempt to bring religion into the classroom. And so they would always equate intelligent design with creationism. And so the petition didn't state my name, but it was clearly targeted at me because I had recently published my book, The Privileged Planet, and there was a documentary released just after that with the same title, and so it was clearly targeting me, and it basically said that intelligent design was not science, and it was something that should be opposed, and that eventually set a very, very negative public atmosphere on campus for anything dealing with intelligent design.
And where did that leave you in terms of trying to find another job?
Yeah, so I was very vulnerable, and I'm sure the people who wrote the petition knew about that. I was not yet tenured when that petition came out, and so I think they had achieved their goal in getting rid of me. And so in spring of 2008, I received a phone call from a professor at Grove City College in the physics department asking whether or not I'd be interested in applying, and I said yes. So I was able to get a job at Grove City College, where I am now, in the physics department. And so I did not have a gap in my employment. Maybe that's not going to be the case for other people in my situation.
I was just about to ask, do you come across other researchers with any kind of regularity that feel chilled about talking about intelligent design or afraid to discuss some of the implications of their research because it indicates intelligent design?
Yes, a number of times I've had professors come to me and say, you know, I agree with your position, you know, but I have to keep quiet about it. There was one professor, genetics department, I believe, at Iowa State, who was somewhat sympathetic to intelligent design, and he received a great deal of criticism. He was already tenured, though, so he was in a safer position. But it's very clear that if you express any kind of even modest support towards intelligent design and in a major university today, you will immediately become the target of vicious attacks from people on blogs, from local professors, and they all write newspaper editorials attacking you. It's like a ton of bricks will come falling on top of you almost immediately. It is just not tolerated on university campuses today.
And what impact does that have on someone's research?
Well, it makes it far less likely that they're going to publish any research that is supportive of intelligent design. And if they do research that tends to be supportive of intelligent design, they'll couch the results in a different language. They'll be very careful not to use the phrase intelligent design. So occasionally you do see research papers that if you read it casually, you know, it sounds, hey, this is supportive of intelligent design, but the author doesn't come out and say it explicitly. You know, it's very clear why not. And not only their colleagues are opposed to it, but also the editors of major scientific journals are opposed to intelligent design. And any paper that is explicitly defending or supporting intelligent design will not get published in journals today. There's maybe, you can count one or two journals that might publish pro-ID papers.
So if the research supports intelligent design, they'll print it so long as nobody confesses the fact that it does actually, or at least outwardly confesses the fact that
That's
it does support intelligent design.
That's correct.
How difficult is it to raise money for research for a professor like yourself who sees evidence and is willing to actually state it of intelligent design? And how has the Discovery Institute been a factor in that?
Yes, it's very difficult to raise money. You can basically forget about getting any money from a government source, such as NASA or the NSF or Institute of Health. You have to go to a private source of funding. The Discovery Institute is one of those private sources that funds intelligent design research, so they've funded some of my research, so I'm very thankful to them. But yes, the sources of funding for intelligent design are extremely limited. Certainly none of the major scientific organizations will fund it.
How important do you think the Discovery Institute is in terms of fighting for academic freedom and aiding others who have experienced what you have?
Yes, the Discovery Institute is very important in defending academic freedom. They are very helpful in the tenure battle that I had at Iowa State University. They provided legal advice. They helped me find attorneys in Iowa to help me through my tenure battles. They filed a Freedom of Information request from Iowa State University, which they eventually won. And so Iowa State had to relinquish lots of documentation, which supported our case. And so I know they've helped other people whose academic freedom has been infringed upon. So they are a very important organization in that respect.
Dr. Gonzalez, thanks so much for your time.
Sure, you're welcome.
Now we'll talk with Dr. Douglas Axe, director of the Biologic Institute, about their research exploring design in nature and the role the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture plays in making it all possible. Dr. Axe, why don't you tell me a little bit about the Biologic Institute?
Well, we are a nonprofit, a 501c3, that was established in 2005. And the purpose for establishing Biologic was a recognition of the fact that there are scientists out there who are interested in rethinking biology from a design perspective. And given the kind of design hostile culture that you encounter in the academy and in the biological sciences in particular, we felt that it was necessary for there to be a new institutional home. It's not that we would relocate everyone into one place, but there would be kind of like a academic society, as it were, where people can be affiliated and do collaborative work together and start to do biology in a new way.
So it serves not only as a centralized research area, but also as a support group in a way.
I wouldn't call it a support group, but that's almost the role, because people who are approaching biology from a non-Darwinian perspective tend to be isolated in their home institutions. And so one of the things we do is just try to connect people. So we have meetings from time to time. We fly people to one place and we talk about projects, talk about research, and we try to build collaborative ties that way as well.
Describe some of the research the Biologic Institute has conducted over the past year and why it's been important.
My own work has focused on enzymes, which are protein molecules. So they're encoded by a gene, and they are protein molecules that have a chemical function. They perform chemistry, chemical conversions. And one of the things that we've been interested in is how tight the constraints are on the genes that encode these things. And so I've been looking at this for a number of years. But in recent years, we've been examining both the adequacy of Darwinism to explain new proteins and new protein functions, and we've been starting to look at what are the design principles by which we should understand things like metabolism, this whole interconnected suite of chemical conversions that allows life in all its forms to function. So we've been moving from single molecules to whole systems, proteomes and genomes, and looking at things like whole cell metabolism. I've also been interested in doing something like that on computers as well as in the laboratory. So we're doing both experimental bench molecular biology and we're doing computational biology.
Where do you hope that that research will lead?
We have an ambitious aim. We think that the Darwinian underpinning of biology has failed it in some very significant respects. And we think that there's a need for an entirely new way of thinking about biology if we're going to understand biology. And it has to be a way that embraces design. That's the conclusion that we've come to. So you can think about it in terms of the difference between mastering spelling versus mastering the art of writing. One could be a very good speller and a miserable writer, or vice versa. And in one case, you're looking at the sort of micromechanics of how you put letters together to make words. But in the other, you are looking at these higher level principles that allow good writing to take place and the principles that you have to master in order to write well. We feel like biology has been stuck kind of in the mechanics as though it's looking at spelling. And it really needs to move to a higher level where it embraces principles, and these principles are manifestly design principles. And we think that life really cannot be understood until you move to that higher level. But biology has been very reluctant to make that move for philosophical reasons.
I know that there are others at the Biologic Institute that are conducting research. Could you share some about their work as well?
Sure. We have people doing everything from astrobiology. So Guillermo Gonzalez, who's in Pennsylvania, is interested in looking at what is needed in order for a planet to support life. So we're at that end of the spectrum. And then our work is looking at molecular biology and metabolism. We also have people who are looking at information from kind of an engineering standpoint. So Bob Marks at Baylor and his group of people are looking at conservation of information principles like the no free lunch theorem and demonstrating that in computer exercises that appear to evolve things, you can always do careful accounting of the information and find out where the information was brought in order for these things to work.
What other research are you gearing up for the next year? What do you expect next year to hold for the Biologic Institute?
Well, we have a paper that we think will be coming out fairly soon in the next few months that really marks our transition from a very careful and thorough critique of Darwinism to fleshing out a new theory of biology, a theory of biological innovation. So, as I said, we are convinced that biology will not be well understood as long as people are viewing it in kind of a reductionistic, Darwinistic way. We think that people have to start looking at biology from the viewpoint of engineers almost and look at principles. So that is where we're going to be moving our own work, not only looking at larger systems like whole metabolism instead of single enzymes, but looking at principles instead of sort of the mechanics of operation. That's where we're headed.
How important would you say Discovery's financial support is, and where else can you go to get funding for this kind of research, and is it easy to get grants or other means of support when you're a supporter of intelligent design?
Good questions. It turns out that the way science works, it is very good at chugging along within the confines of an established paradigm, but it's not at all good at challenging that paradigm. And the reason for that is everyone invests in the reigning paradigm from the point where they're graduate students just getting credentialed to do scientific research on up through their scientific careers. They've basically grown up under a paradigm and then they invest their entire careers under the umbrella of that paradigm. And so understandably, people who have done that are very reluctant to see the paradigm that they've invested so much in be challenged or even toppled, torn apart. However, as we know from the history of science, there are times when the reigning paradigm, the orthodoxy of the day, has been just plain wrong. And so in those cases, the paradigm does need to be toppled. And I think the history of science also shows that it takes patron organization or a sponsor of some kind who believes in the paradigm shift and backs it not just for 1 year, but for basically a generation until a lot of young scientists can be brought on board. And that is the role that I think Discovery Institute has played. They've taken a lot of criticism, as you know, for backing something that is counter to the orthodoxy in biology, but that is precisely what is needed here. And they've done it for the long haul. They have been committed to this now for decades, and that commitment will continue. And that's the kind of commitment you need in this situation, because all of the standard funding sources are beholden to peer review, and that means they get the opinion of practicing biologists. And as I said, almost all of these biologists are thoroughly wed to the Darwinian orthodoxy. And so they're not going to approve money being given to something that challenges that.
What would happen in a world without the Discovery Institute? What would happen to your research and what would happen to your institute?
Well, as it is, there are relatively few people who are in a position like mine where they can roll up their sleeves and do work that is challenging the orthodoxy in biology. If Discovery Institute did not exist, I would probably be hunkered down somewhere like I think a lot of other people are, pretending to be a Darwinist, but secretly doing some work that I think will chip away at the orthodoxy. And there are a lot of people who are approaching it that way. But ultimately, that is a very slow way to change a paradigm. We need to have people who can confront the paradigm head on. And that's what's made possible by a funding body like Discovery that wants to see that happen, that wants to see all the ideas compete head to head.
Dr. Axe, thanks so much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
Next, we turn to Dr. David Berlinski, who might be familiar to you from the movie Expelled or the DVD The Incorrigible Dr. Berlinski. Dr. Berlinski is a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture and the author of numerous books and articles. Dr. Berlinski spoke to me on the phone from his home in Paris about the enormous impact the Discovery Institute is having on science, academic freedom, and the culture. Let me just start by asking you, how important is the Discovery Institute?
Well, I think the real answer to that question is important to whom and to what. I think it's terrifically important for the health, the vigorous health of the intellectual community, that's even larger than the scientific community, the general intellectual community, because the sheer fact of the matter is nobody else is doing what the Discovery Institute has been able to do. And that has really put an entire scientific establishment on the defensive, forced for the first time really critically to respond to some very, very significant damaging criticism. That is terrifically important. And my only wish in that regard is that it would be a much larger, more powerful institution, because when you look at the whole spectrum of scientific opinion, intellectual opinion in the United States, there is so very little dissent, so very little criticism, just a blank, gray, uniform agreement on positions that the American people seem to find very suspect. So in that regard, I think it's terrifically important.
And is the Discovery Institute the only institution of its kind doing this?
Well, for sure there are a lot of think tanks, intellectual organizations that are discussing sometimes with surprising sophistication, economic and political and historical affairs. That is certainly true, policy issues. But when you move away from, let's call it, the softer sciences to the core issues of biology, the core issues that surround biological claims, then I have a very difficult time imagining any other institute that's doing this kind of work. In fact, I can't think of a single one. And again, that is extremely striking, because it is not, emphatically not, because people aren't having subversive or critical or heterodox thoughts. It is because it's so difficult, so incredibly difficult to find an institutional platform with which to express them. Not a matter, but a significant matter, I think.
Is the Discovery Institute on the rise? In other words, critics of the Discovery Institute, people who want to dismiss them, say, well, it's a fringe group. It's isolated to just a few individuals. They're not talking about serious ideas. How would you respond to those kinds of criticisms?
I think the overwhelming response is that however marginal the Discovery Institute may be in the eyes of its critics, it has accomplished an enormous, enormous amount in terms of challenging the biological establishment, the Darwinian establishment, and shaking it up profoundly. Every time you hear the voiced objection, well, the Discovery Institute's just peddling the same old stuff, it plays no role, it has no influence, just look at the volume of attacks directed against the institution. If it were really true that it was as marginal as its critics say, you would hear deafening silence.
Is the message of the Discovery Institute, is the example of the Discovery Institute spreading among scientists, in your opinion?
That's really hard to say, because there are two completely different profiles that established scientists offer. One is the public profile, in which they're obliged, for reasons of financial security, for reasons of prestige, for reasons of the comfort of their friends, and for reasons of political reasons with respect to their positions, to obey what is, in effect, a party line. It's a harsh term, but I think a condign one. And then there is what a great many scientists say amongst themselves, to themselves. In the second respect, the private opinion of important scientists, I think that the reach of the Discovery Institute has been very remarkable. I speak to a great many people who say, in effect, the same thing, that the criticisms that have been made over the last 15 years have been tremendously influential, tremendously trenchant. They've had a serious effect. They changed in many, many ways the way the scientific community is thinking about certain issues. Certain concepts have simply entered into discourse, no matter how often they're criticized. Mike Beatty's concept of irreducible complexity is an example. Steve Meyer, William Dembski talk about complex specified information. There's a grudging but nonetheless honest admission that even though these concepts may in the future need to be refined, I think that's probably true, they do represent a significant issue within the larger framework of current theories in biology. These are really remarkable properties of biological structures, especially molecular biological structures, for which we don't have a prayer of an explanation right now.
When donors and others support the Discovery Institute, what would you say that they're supporting? What would you tell them?
It's a tricky question, because people become donors for a variety of reasons. I would say, this is my position, it's not the Discovery Institute's position, because I don't have their authority to speak on this particular issue, but I would say, look, something like a heterodox think tank, a center for intellectual dissent, within the sciences and addressed to the sciences, is not only badly needed, it's urgently needed. And if you want to break the stranglehold of what is plainly an orthodoxy of opinion in the scientific and academic communities, this is the best place you could go to break that stranglehold. Because you can't do it as an individual. And here is an institution which is more than an individual, and it has the powers of an institution. And support in this direction will magnify your own sense of competence 1,000-fold. I think that's an important point to stress.
Dr. Belinsky, thanks so much for making the time. It's been great to speak with you again.
My pleasure entirely.
I hope Dr. Belinsky has really driven home for you how unique the Discovery Institute is and what an essential role they play in renewing scientific debate. Next, I'm joined by Casey Luskin of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Casey, tell me about the importance of the Discovery Institute's ability to help raise money to defend students, professors, and scientists who come under attack for expressing views sympathetic to intelligent design.
Well, it's extremely important. For one, there is a widespread pattern of intolerance and discrimination against pro-ID scientists and students and other folks that are out there. We've been seeing this for a number of years at Discovery Institute. And many of these people, when they face discrimination, they don't know where to turn to. They have nowhere else to go. They know of Discovery Institute because we are one of the biggest names, probably the biggest name in the ID movement. So they come to us, and we need to be able to have the resources, the connections, and the staff people basically to be able to support and help defend these people. Additionally, one of the major things we do is that people face discrimination. They come to us and we help them find the legal representation they need. But even once they get that legal representation, the support that we provide doesn't end, because a lot of the attorneys that are out there that do the work defending these people who have faced discrimination, these scientists or students or whatever they are, these attorneys are not necessarily specialists in intelligent design. They don't know the issue very well, and we can provide the expertise and be the one-stop shop where they can get everything they need to know. They can get experience as far as previous cases, scientific advice, knowledge of the nuances of the debate. There's really nowhere else that both people who have been persecuted or the people who are representing the persecuted can turn to other than us to get all the information they need to put together a successful defense.
And what's at stake for these people that come to you, for scientists and students and others who come to you and say, look, I'm suffering discrimination in this way. What's at stake for them usually?
Well, often what's at stake is their careers, their livelihoods, their ability to go to the same job each day and not have to find a new job or move to a new university, which might be out of state, which means leaving your community, leaving your friends, leaving all the work that you've done at your present school. So there's a lot at stake. For students, it might mean getting your degree or being able to pursue that graduate degree that you've always dreamed of. For some folks, it means just being able to show a pro-intelligent design video at a local theater, just being able to reach out to your community. So the bottom common denominator here between all of these different problems that people face is free speech. Do they have the free speech rights to talk about intelligent design? And whether you are actually pro or anti-intelligent design, you should support free speech. I like to say that it doesn't really matter where you feel about intelligent design or where you stand on the issue. Everybody should support free speech to be for or against or wherever you happen to stand on intelligent design. And when we lose free speech to support intelligent design, I think everybody loses, because free speech is one of those fundamental values that really undergirds free society and our ability to have intellectual freedom to follow the evidence where it leads. And I think that's a value that everyone agrees with. So when you don't have the freedom to support intelligent design, that's something that everybody should be concerned about.
So not only does the Discovery Institute need resources to fight for academic freedom and to fight for academic freedom for both students and professors, but also, as you alluded to there, in communities at large where people who are just trying to introduce the concept of intelligent design have found themselves shut down at public institutions and being prevented in part from doing things like renting a room to be able to talk about these things.
That's right. The intolerance almost knows no bounds. It's amazing. And of course, many of our ID the Future listeners heard about the AFA versus California Science Center case earlier this year, where all AFA wanted to do was rent out a publicly owned IMAX theater so they could show a pro-intelligent design video. That's all they wanted to do. And yet they were prevented from doing so. And so this is just about having literally the freedom to talk about intelligent design. You would think that things haven't gotten that bad, but they actually have in some places. Folks do not want any viewpoints or voices expressed that support intelligent design. And we're here to make sure that people have the right to defend their legal freedoms to talk about intelligent design.
And without the Discovery Institute, we're talking about people all over the country having to basically reinvent the wheel, trying to figure out how they can fight against these things, whereas Discovery has the experience, the expertise, and should be able to provide the resources that they need to be able to successfully challenge these kinds of discriminatory acts.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've helped literally dozens of people over the years who have faced discrimination of some kind or another because they support intelligent design. And again, it might have been a scientist who was denied tenure or lost a job. It might have been a student who was facing threats so they wouldn't get their degree. It might have been somebody who was prevented from renting out a room, or in this case of David Coppedge in his lawsuit against JPL, somebody who just wanted to share pro-intelligent design videos with colleagues in the workplace and then was essentially demoted and then fired, according to his lawsuit, for doing so. So it's runs gambit of freedom of speech to talk about this issue. But yeah, there's all kinds of cases that can arise. And again, these folks, they don't know where to turn, and we're the place that they can turn.
There's another aspect to the work of the Discovery Institute in this regard as well. By defending, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but by defending aggressively these academic freedoms and the freedom of speech when it comes to sharing the ideas of intelligent design, you're also preemptively making it more difficult for this kind of discrimination to happen, because people see these precedents, they see that it's not easy to bully people, and it starts to move the needle the opposite direction when it comes to getting people to realize, hey, we're going to have to deal with this intellectually, we can't just shut it down.
That's right. It intimidates the intimidators, so to speak, because right. There's a lot of intimidation out there. I mean, there's actually a real culture of intimidation today in the scientific community. If you are an ID proponent, you will feel that culture of intimidation. You will know every day you are swimming in this culture where you do not feel the same freedoms to just be yourself, to be an ID proponent, to express your views as other folks might, to be an evolutionist or to oppose intelligent design. And it's one of those things that you don't necessarily understand it or even realize it's there until you are on the side of it where you're the one who's being intimidated and who's feeling that pressure to not speak out. But it's very real. I experienced it myself when I was a graduate student. And so, but sometimes that culture of intimidation actually manifests itself in real world ways where people are prevented from getting jobs, or they don't get funding, or they don't get the grants that otherwise they should deserve simply because of their support for ID. So again, this is very real, and people need to have a place to turn when they face these kinds of problems. And if you don't stand up to these bullies and you don't push back and assert the legal freedoms that people have to just simply express the pro-ID view, then this culture of intimidation will thrive. It will succeed. And so we're really trying to empower folks to have the courage and the freedom to speak out against this culture of intimidation that says, if you're pro-ID, you should just basically stay in the closet about it.
Casey Luskin, thanks so much. Thank you for listening to this end-of-the-year podcast for the Discovery Institute. Please take the time to think about what you've heard in this podcast, the importance of the work the Discovery Institute is doing to preserve academic freedom and the ability to question a strictly materialist worldview. The Discovery Institute couldn't do it without support from people like you. The cost to challenge Darwinist orthodoxy can be high, but we think searching for the truth is worth it. If you agree, we hope you'll support the work of the Discovery Institute and the Center for Science and Culture. You can donate online at discovery.org. Just click Join Discovery to find out how. You can also mail a check to the Discovery Institute at 208 Columbia Street, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Again, that's 208 Columbia Street, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Thank you. The Discovery Institute hopes you've enjoyed this podcast for the Center for Science and Culture. It's copyright Discovery Institute with all rights reserved.